Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. Imagine trying to keep yourself warm and well-fed in the winter while carrying around a crowd of 35,000 blood-sucking parasites on your back. The mere thought is enough to turn you white as a ghost. And that's the title of Dr. Bill Samuel's new book on the plight of tick-ridden moose. And Thesis, the Center for Innovation Studies, presented its first conference to promote an innovation-based economy. Peter Josty, Chris Lum, and Medicine Hat's John Molden speak out on some of the issues discussed at InnoWest 2004. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. By the time late winter arrives, moose across Alberta will be itching to get rid of the ticks that suck the blood from their hides. Some moose get such heavy infestations, they literally rub their coats off, and they're left with grayish-white stubble that gives them a ghostly appearance. Ticks can suck up more blood than a calf moose can replace, and a hairless ghost moose can die of hypothermia if caught in a late spring snowstorm. During his long career at the University of Alberta, Dr. Bill Samuel has studied the terrible effect these infestations have on moose. He's now gathered his observations and experiences into his first book, and it's titled White as a Ghost, Winter Ticks and Moose.
Well, what got me interested in the first place was many years ago, 1976, I believe, I had a chat while I was hunting moose on a cut line. An older fellow came along who happened to be a trapper, an outdoor enthusiast. His name was Cecil Cross. He now lives in Barrhead. And Cecil gave me a little workshop right there on the cut line about diseases and parasites that a young person who was studying wildlife in Alberta should be working on. And one of the things he told me I should be studying were ghost moose. That is, animals that were sick or dying and didn't look all that well. They were gray in color in March and April, in late winter and early spring, throughout central Alberta, that were covered with winter ticks. And he caught my interest, and that started my research on winter ticks. And this book kind of summarizes the research I've done since 1976 on this tick.
One of the descriptions I liked about the ticks was the way they move around, and that's very unusual, and it's something that perhaps hasn't been documented before. Tell me about that.
Well, we found some interesting things. The ticks drop off the moose in May, and then they lay their eggs, and the eggs become young ticks in the fall. They become seed ticks. And in late August and September and October, these seed ticks, which are about the size of a piece of sand, they climb the vegetation in order to ambush moose as they come down trails. And they do several things that enhance ambushing moose. And one of the things they do is they form in clumps, in aggregations. And these aggregations, when a moose comes down a trail, these aggregations of seed ticks get very excited. What excites them is they have sensory structures on their legs that are able to detect carbon dioxide. So when a moose is breathing coming down a trail, these ticks get very excited. The closer the moose gets, the more excited the ticks get. And I found that ticks do a number of things when they interlock their legs so that when the tick on the outside of the clump touches the hair coat of a moose, that tick grabs onto the hair and literally drags other members of the clump onto the moose. So one tick getting on a moose basically drags on a whole pile of ticks, which is probably one of the reasons that they form in clumps to enable them to better ambush moose. And one of the other things that I've seen, and I'm not sure it's been reported for any tick in the world, maybe it has, but I haven't seen it, and that is when these ticks get very excited, they actually jump. That is, they flip like a tiddlywink or flipping a coin. They only move a couple of millimeters because they're only the size of a piece of sand, small sand at that. But they only need to get a couple of millimeters to get onto a host. So when they get really excited, they'll actually flip, hoping that they'll flip onto the host.
One of the things you mentioned is that the moose is actually maladapted to this tick, so it's relatively early in this parasite host evolution. How is it then that the moose actually ended up with these ticks?
Well, that's a good question. I do think that moose are maladapted, and I base that on a number of things that we observe when we compare moose, elk, and let's say the number of ticks on deer. The average number of ticks on moose, is, as I said, often exceeds 30, 50, even 80,000, huge numbers on moose, whereas the number on elk is often 3,000, 3,500, and the number on white-tailed deer is often 100 to 500. And one of the adaptations of deer and elk is that in the fall, when the larvae come off the vegetation and attack these animals, when they get on a deer or an elk in the autumn, the first thing that those animals do is they sense that the ticks are on them, and they turn around and lick them off virtually immediately. I call that program grooming. They appear to be programmed to regularly groom against ticks. Whereas moose, being maladapted, when those ticks climb on in the fall, the moose do virtually nothing. They do not respond until they are really bitten by the large tick life stages in the late winter, starting from January and February in through March and April. So they are grooming, which is what deer do, but they are grooming much too late to have much of an effect. So they want to do the right things, but it appears like that they have not been in association with this tick for near as long as deer and possibly elk. So how might that have happened? It's possible that the deer had these ticks, and when, let's say, between 1850 and early 1900s, when settlers were moving into the southern part of the boreal forest along the St. Lawrence Seaway, along the Great Lakes, it's possible that as they cut down trees to open the forest to create agriculture, that this attracted deer. Deer love edges, so they would love the early successional stages of plants that would grow along clearings and in clearings. So deer, I think, would have been attracted from the south and moved into the habitat of moose, and I think the deer said, I've got a present for you guys. It'll help me compete against you. I'm going to give you this winter tick. And I think that that's possibly when they got the tick. There are other possibilities as well, and I do talk about those in the book. We really don't know, so they're just theories. They're just ideas I have. One of the goals of the book is to hopefully stimulate research by young people that are interested in this fascinating association, and maybe they'll learn more about this and be able to definitively answer the question.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Bill Samuel, Professor Emeritus in Biological Sciences and Associate Dean of Research for the Faculty of Science at the University of Alberta. He's also acting leader of ACRU, the Alberta Cooperative Conservation Research Unit. Bill's book is called White as a Ghost, and it's published by the Federation of Alberta Naturalists. Industry folks, policymakers, and people with grand ideas gathered in Calgary recently at InnoWest 2004. This conference, designed to stimulate discussion and new ideas to foster an innovation-based economy in the West, was hosted by Thesis, the Center for Innovation Studies. Peter Josty is the executive director of Thesis and the conference chair.
We set up Thesis about 3 years ago with the intention of being a company to stimulate interest in innovation and to try and advance the use of innovation through the whole economy. And we felt that sooner or later we would have to do a conference. So we decided that now was the time, and we set about organizing the InnoWest conference The reason we did this was that we found that, and this is a Western Canadian conference, we found that the four Western provinces have a great deal in common. They've all got economies that are based upon the resource sector, so it's trees and oil and gas and cattle and agriculture and fishing, and all of those areas are subject to certain kind of stresses at the moment. We've got mad cow disease, we've got soft barriers to softwood lumber, we've got drought, we've got the depletion of oil reserves. So when you look towards the future, there's a significant threat that these resource sectors don't have the growth potential to allow the industry to grow, to add the economies to grow, to give us the standard of living and quality of life we expect. So one of the important things I think we have to do in Western Canada is move up the food chain. So instead of exporting unprocessed commodities, we export more value-added products with more innovation, getting more into the knowledge economy. And that requires a different mindset from all of the people. So what we're really trying to do with this conference is try and influence people's mindset so that they can think more in terms of innovation, the value-added economy, and less about exporting unprocessed commodities, because we think the time for that is beginning to run out.
Well, you've set up a number of different themes within the sessions. What are you trying to achieve with those? What would those themes be?
Well, on day two of the workshop, we've got four interactive workshops. And what we're trying to do with these workshops is come up with some very specific ideas. For example, we've got one workshop on health innovation. And one of the, whenever you think about health innovation, people always think, boy, this is going to cost a lot of money. It's a drain. It's a drag on our economy. But the focus we're trying to take in this particular workshop is to say, instead of using health innovation as a drain, let's think, how can we create a globally competitive healthcare industry such that we can then create wealth from this instead of regarding it as a drain on the system? And the other workshops are things like ICT, energy, and bioproducts, where we're trying to focus people on. So what, and these, we see these as some of the growth areas for the Western Canadian economy. And so we're trying to get some ideas surfaced as to how can we actually do something constructive to make these things happen more quickly.
Well, along at this conference, you have a pretty significant list of keynote speakers, and we've just heard the luncheon talk by Dr. Martha Piper, who's the president at UBC, but who's also from Edmonton. And when she started giving her ideas of innovation and creativity, I wanted to stand up on my chair and yell hurrah, because she was actually saluting the arts, the bohemian community. What did you think of what she had to say? How does that fit in with our ideas about technology and new economy and that sort of thing?
Well, I think she's right on the money, because we always face a little bit of an uphill battle, because those of us, and I include myself in that group, who've had a background in the hard sciences, tend to think that science and engineering is really what it's all about. But if you look at the big picture and you ask yourself, well, what makes some of these things happen? It's a lot of the softer things, and as Martha Piper was saying, this work by Richard Florida showing that people, creative people, move to where there are good cultural opportunities. Things like the Calgary Philharmonic Orchestra, these are really important, not because they're sort of things that are nice to have as a status symbol, but people want to live in places like Calgary because of the cultural amenities, and if you don't have them, you're not going to have the people. If you don't have the people, you don't have the ideas. And if you don't have the ideas, you can't have the innovation. So we totally agree with that approach. And that's one of the things we're trying to build on this conference. One of our workshops this morning was on building a culture of innovation. And we feel these soft issues are really some of the more harder issues to deal with in innovation.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you.
That was Peter Josty, executive director of Thesis and chair of InnoWest 2004. Speaking on the issue of creating a culture of innovation was Chris Lum. Chris is the president and CEO of Microline. This very successful company producing microfluidic devices got its start as a spin-off from the University of Alberta.
I would say that a culture of innovation is one which, in which innovation or change is welcomed within a company and sought after, and which is part of what drives the company forward to make it a better place to achieve its objectives, whatever those may be.
Why is that so important?
Well, companies can't be static, especially a technology company. A technology company that does the same thing next year as it did last year, in terms of delivering exactly the same things to the same customers, is basically going nowhere. And pretty much everybody, I think, who is running or working in a technology company is doing that because they want to see some application of the technology for some better future, whether it be a better product in the market, a bigger company that they're working for, a more exciting job, something like that. And so anything, a technology company that doesn't change is essentially dying. So they have to change. Now, how do they change? They change through innovation, and because almost any change that you think of would require innovation of some sort. You know, it might be a new product that you bring to market. It might be a way of managing your supply chain differently. It might be a way of getting to market differently. It might be a way of making your product or service internally more efficiently. So there's any number of things that could qualify as innovation. But I see it just as the core ingredient of growth of a company, and we all want our companies to grow.
Microline started as a spin-off company from the University of Alberta and as a not-for-profit, and at some point you had to decide to become a private company, and that's what you have addressed in the session today. At what point did that realization come?
It was a gradual realization over several years. We had grown the commercial business of the organization quite significantly. We were continuing to do that, and we realized that there was a number of limitations in staying as a not-for-profit. I can list some of them, but one of those that as a not-for-profit, you have a different mandate. You have a mandate to provide some service consistent with your objectives as a not-for-profit company. And in our case, it was a provincial economic development objective. You can't raise capital within a not-for-profit company. You can't necessarily provide equity incentives to your employees. You can't be as clear as you'd like to be with your customers about really who you are, whether you're a part of the university, part of the government, whether you're really in the business of providing service to customers or whether you're in some other business. So there was a number of things that were limitations, and we reached a point where we said the only way that we can continue growing the company, realizing the potential that we've got within this company, is to become a private company.
In doing that, then, how did you bring along your people so that you could then reach this potential for innovation and continued growth?
Well, it wasn't just the people within the company. There was a lot of different stakeholders that were involved in going through this transition because we were owned by the university, and we had employees, and we had a board of directors, and we had people within the university who were using our services to a certain extent. And so we had to be able to convey to all of these people on their terms why it would be better, why the future would be better if we made this a private company rather than stayed as a not-for-profit. So because all of these different groups of people had slightly different ways of looking at our company, it had to work for all of them. So we had to have a good vision of the future, and we had to be able to convey it to these stakeholders, as we call them, in a way that made sense to them. And it had to make sense for each of them, in that they personally felt that having Microline be a private company was better than having it stay as a not-for-profit. So a lot of it came down to having the vision, repeating it over and over, listening to these stakeholders and understanding what concerns they might have and being able to address them, being able to build a consensus amongst enough of these people that they felt that it was worthwhile doing. So it's a long process, and one where you can't just sort of make a decision one day and go through a transition the next day. You have to get a lot of people on side.
Now that you have taken that leap and you've proven the company to be successful in that approach, how do you then maintain that sense of innovation, that culture, or that freshness on a day-to-day basis?
It's a different world now than it was then, in the sense that we were going through a major change, and we went through that change, and we grew the company, and now we're quite well established as a private company. So the vision of the future has to be continually recreated. Maybe not every day, but certainly, you know, probably every year anyway. You've got to be able to take a look at it, say, does it still make sense? Are we achieving what we want to achieve? Are there new directions we should go in? And many of the same principles apply, though. You've got to be able to have a clear vision of where you want to go. It's got to be compelling. It's got to be able to be communicated easily. And it has to be something that people can get behind and buy into. And so we have to continue to do that all the time.
Thank you very much, Chris.
You're welcome.
That was Chris Lum, President and CEO of Microline. He was speaking about creating a culture of innovation at the InnoWest 2004 conference. Innovation doesn't just happen in the big cities, but nurturing new ideas and bringing them to fruition poses bigger challenges for inventors and entrepreneurs living in rural communities. John Molden is coordinator for the Medicine Hat Innovators Network. He outlined his experiences at the InnoWest session devoted to rural ventures.
Well, Medicine Hat is a city of about 50,000 people itself. The adjacent town of Red Cliff and the area probably adds another 10,000. And by the time we take in the whole corner of the province, I guess we're up in this maybe 70,000 people. The industry there is oil and gas, but the old industry and the major one still is farming, cattle ranching, cow-calf operations, some irrigated farming, a lot of dry land farming, and more recently, greenhouses have started to play a bigger role.
Now, you've been instrumental in setting up something called the Medicine Hat Innovators Network. How did you get involved in that?
Well, my background is as a research manager. I was for some years at the Defense Research Establishment in Suffield and became interested in technology entrepreneurship, largely from the point of view of the laboratory and the opportunities for young companies to work with the government laboratory to pick up ideas and to translate them into good businesses in the community. After I retired, I thought I'd like to look at this more carefully and see what we could do in our community to try and get more of that technology entrepreneurship going in the Medicine Hat area.
What are some of the challenges that face entrepreneurs and innovators in the rural communities like Medicine Hat? Because when you look at a lot of the innovation activity, as it were, it seems to be associated with the large cities, with the research universities. How do you deal with that disparity?
That's right. And that does make it difficult. And for example, what I found as I started working with people, I found lots of little groups of people that were doing very innovative things, had nice little companies going, but they didn't know of one another's existence even. So one of the things we want to do is try and draw them together so that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That kind of thing happens easier, I think, in a big area where you do have universities, research centers. But we have resources of our own. Some of the resources that took us some time to identify and they're taking us some time to figure out how to use effectively. One of the most important being, I believe, is the very close proximity of this large national laboratory that generates a lot of technology, a lot of ideas. The difference, though, between that and a university is that it in itself doesn't have the mandate to be an engine of economic development. Its mandate is to support the Canadian forces. So our challenge as a community has been to do what we need to do to put the infrastructure in place so that we become a valued partner to that laboratory and we can use the opportunity that's presented us.
You also need investment, though, the dollars to actually take these ideas and put them out into the marketplace. Is that there?
The dollars are there. What we found is that you really need to get the ideas developed to the point of view that they the investors can become interested and confident that there's not only a brilliant technical idea, but that there's a business capability to go with it, or at least, at the very least, an awareness by the entrepreneur that they need to have that business side on their company. Now, they may not want or should provide that themselves, and that's where mentoring can come in. And a lot of investors are prepared to mentor, but what they need to see is that the other elements are there as well.
You made a presentation today at the InnoWest 2004 session dealing with the rural communities and innovation. What lessons do you think other communities in Alberta can learn from what you've had to do in Medicine Hat?
Well, what we've done in Medicine Hat, and I think similar things have been happening in the Grand Prairie region and in the Red Deer region, is you really need to get a lot of people on board. When you come out of the research and development community, you kind of accept that it's a given that the research and development is a good thing and technology is a good thing. But what you find as you start working with other people is that those values aren't necessarily shared immediately. And there's a fair bit of work that's involved just understanding where other people are coming from, understanding what the other elements are that contribute to economic development, contribute to people investing in things, and get your ideas forward and get it all merged into a common goal.
Have you seen any ideas come to fruition yet?
Yes. We've had some excellent things come about in Medicine Hat. One is the Light Book Company. Now, we don't take any credit for that, but it's a great example of an entrepreneur that had an idea, that he had the business sense and the sense to get help to build now, which is a very, very attractive business.
And what is that?
Well, the Light Book is a very interesting device. It deals with the syndrome of people in northern climates where they don't, I guess, get enough sunshine. And for some people, that can cause depression. It can cause other issues. And by artificially creating that light, that can be overcome. The original ways of doing that were very cumbersome type of devices. The breakthrough in the Light Book is that it's a very convenient, easy to use, attractive product that people are more likely to use.
What's next on the agenda for the Medicine Hat Innovators Network?
Well, we'd really want to concentrate now on capturing the opportunities at the research lab at Suffield. We're moving now forward to creating an incubator facility, a very modest one, but one which will allow people to come together rather than these individual entrepreneurs working out of their basement or their garage or a room above a butcher shop, to get them together in a little bit better laboratory, give them some legitimacy, give them, most important, the opportunity of working together on a day-to-day basis.
So you're actually building a building?
Very, very modest building, but one that I think will serve a useful purpose.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Cheryl.
That was John Molden, coordinator for the Medicine Hat Innovators Network. I also spoke to Chris Lum of Microline and Peter Josty, conference chair for InnoWest 2004. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Research Council, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, the University of Lethbridge, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Crozier.